Welcome to The Bridge, a weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgane, your host for the show. The city of Astoria is continuing with its program of selling surplus property. Citizens are continuing to question the details of the program.
The fact is, you've gone ahead time and again and sold these for much less than they're worth.
We'll hear about the first failed sale in the city's excess property sales program. That story coming up in about 6 minutes. Also on the show, we'll hear about political nonprofits that are changing the way campaigns are run on the national and increasingly on the state level. Austin Jenkins reports on how issue advocacy groups are changing the political landscape. NPR News headlines are next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgane. The city of Astoria is continuing with its program of selling surplus property. Citizens are continuing to question the details of the program. Public hearings on each sale take place during regular city council meeting. Only one lot was under consideration at this week's meeting, one of a parcel of five city-owned lots on Birch Street in Alderbrook. Mike and Judith Cahill, who own property adjacent to the lot, offered a bid of $12,000 for the property. The Cahills were not at the meeting, but there was plenty of public comment about the proposed sale, and the program itself was the subject of questions and comments from several attendees. Astorian George McCartan expressed misgivings about the program and the practice of offering neighboring property owners the first chance to bid on the properties. He said the result is reduced prices for a select group solely because their property is adjacent to a property the city deems to be surplus. He also questioned the city's asking price for the Birch Street lot, saying because this lot is level, buildable, and has a partial view of the river, it should command a higher price.
The fact is, you've gone ahead time and again and sold these for much less than they're worth. And you've also sold them at a time when we're just starting to come out of the slump. And you could, just stalling off to wait a year or two would pay you off at least a few thousand dollars on each of these parcels. But this one here, it's disturbing that the offer, the asking price was $14,000, which is a bargain basement price, and the offer is that you're considering is $12,000.
Doris Queener of Astoria, a neighbor of the Cahills, also expressed her concern about the property sales.
And I'm speaking for myself, but I'm aware of other citizens of Astoria who are concerned about this process of selling city property. What I would like to see is that the council stop the process and allow further discussion of the whole process and hear from other concerned citizens in Astoria. And that includes a group that are gathering signatures, and we'd like to present those signatures at the next city council meeting.
Astorian Shell Cantor asked several questions seeking clarification on the total number of city lots deemed excess, the period of time expected to complete the sales, and requested that mapping and property details for each of the properties be made available online. He also asked if there were expected numbers of additional housing units that could spread the costs of water and sewer for Astoria residents. If the actual costs to the city of maintaining the surplus properties have been determined, and if there have been formal appraisals for the value of trees on the properties. City Manager Paul Benoit spoke up to address Cantor's concerns.
The properties that are deemed excess by the council were brought to a council meeting, so they were in the minutes that you were reviewing, and I don't have them memorized. But Ken, do you recall, or Brett, anyone, how many parcels are in this first grouping that we're bringing? I think it's so that the 30 that you mentioned, and I think those are the ones identified there, and we brought them to the council with an entire list of those 30. That's it. Those are the only ones that have been deemed excess. And so the agreement was that we would just work from that list, and before anything gets added to it, we would bring another group back to the city council for a public hearing and a discussion. So today and on into the foreseeable future, it's that group of 30-something. And again, the maps are on the website and they're on the wall. We can make them more for you.
Benoit said only the city council can declare property to be excess. Staff can develop a list of recommendations, but declaring excess property is not a staff decision. The timeline for completion of sales has not been determined. Sales have been slow, indicating the lower prices are appropriate for the lots offered for sale so far. Details on the lots as to suitability for building and other factors are available for the 30 lots to be sold, but descriptions written to comply with state regulations may not align with actual uses permitted by the city.
So we have data on the 30. We also have what is called, and it's an unfortunate name because it implies that we want to build on them, but the state of Oregon under Oregon statute requires every city to, on a regular basis, to prepare a buildable lands inventory. Doesn't mean any city wants to build on those lands. It's just a state term of art. And so that is a published report. It's on the city website. And that goes through pretty exhaustive detail. And that's, you know, the tool that we've been using together with just local knowledge zoning maps. But the BLI is something that's accessible on the website. And that's the tool that Mike Morgan and company were using to try to develop the list of 30.
In answer to Cantor's additional questions, Mayor Van Dusen could not offer any assurance that property sales would have any mitigating effects for Astorians in the costs of water and sewer, nor was a total maintenance cost to the city available. Councilman Russ Ward did say the small income derived from returning the parcels to the tax rolls would be a public benefit, as would the reduced liability for the city if it no longer owns the parcels. City Manager Benoit said if a property with harvestable timber were to be sold, the value of the timber would be a factor in the sales price. At the conclusion of the public hearing, City Manager Benoit stated the staff recommendation was to accept the bid from Mike and Judith Cahill of $12,000. Council Member Karen Malin moved to accept the bid, seconded by Council Member Russ Ward. Citing the lack of any testimony in favor of the sale, Mayor Van Dusen said he could not support it. Council members Herzig, Lemire, and Mayor Van Dusen voted against the sale of the Birch Street property, which then failed, with only three against, only Ward and Malin in favor. You've heard of Carl Rove's Crossroads GPS and other issue advocacy groups that don't have to disclose their donors. They're transforming American politics. These political nonprofits also exist at the state level, but much of this activity is coming from the left, not the right. And instead of TV ad campaigns, the work is largely happening online and on the ground. Correspondent Austin Jenkins reports on what has emerged as a perpetual campaign.
I'm standing in the lobby of the Vance building in downtown Seattle looking at the tenant list, and it is a who's who of, quote, progressive nonprofits. In fact, you might think of this building as the headquarters of the progressive movement in Washington. Up on the third floor of this building, you'll find the most visible member of this network, an organization called Fuse Washington.
Okay. So, the Dream Act, which is...
On this day, nearly a dozen young staffers crowd around a table in a cramped conference room. Field Director Aaron Hike updates the team on one of Fuse's top priorities this legislative session, passage of the so-called Dream Act to give state college aid to undocumented high school graduates. It passed the Washington House with overwhelming bipartisan support on day one of the session.
We did a Facebook share on it that got 14,000 views and 121 shares to kind of continue the momentum for the Senate.
The plan is to keep the pressure on Senate Majority Leader Rodney Tom to allow a vote on the DREAM Act. Just outside the door of the conference room is a large photoshopped poster of Tom wearing a jeweled crown. Around here, he's known as King Tom, an unflattering nickname Fuse gave the Democrat last year after he joined with Republicans to form a majority coalition. Even so, Aaron Ostrom, Fuse's executive director, insists Fuse is nonpartisan.
We don't really care what the letter is after somebody's name, right? We care about their values and their willingness to lead on behalf of ordinary people.
Fuse is a 501c4 social welfare organization that doesn't have to disclose its donors. It's part of a network of left-of-center nonprofits, most created in the last 5 to 7 years in Washington. They include think tanks, a candidate recruitment and training organization, and even a bus that goes around the state to register and mobilize young voters. Together, these organizations represent a powerful campaign that never ends to make what supporters call progressive social and political change in Washington. It's a network that has the potential to eclipse individual candidates and even the state Democratic Party itself.
There's nothing, you know, mysterious about this.
Nick Hanauer is a Seattle venture capitalist and prominent political donor. He was one of the early contributors to what became the Progress Alliance of Washington, funded by very successful, even wealthy liberal activists. The alliance is also housed in the Vance Building.
It's simply a group of people who share a vision about the kind of politics we want, the kind of state we want, working together to, you know, organize those efforts.
Over the last 8 years, they've given about $8 million to seed and support this network of progressive nonprofits. Because the Progress Alliance is also a nonprofit, it doesn't have to disclose its donors. But Hanauer says the alliance is not using its IRS status as a way to conceal the identity of its funders.
Until the rules change, and we'd be very supportive of those rule changes. You know, we're playing the game by the rules that have been defined.
This model, deep-pocketed funders, a network of nonprofits, and a goal of long-term progressive change, actually started in Colorado in 2004. Since then, it's been replicated in some form in nearly 24 states. Someone who's closely watched the rise of this network in Washington is Republican strategist Randy Pepl. He managed gubernatorial candidate Rob McKenna's 2012 campaign and is quite familiar with Fuse.
Well, Fuse's primary responsibility was to be out there attacking Rob McKenna every day and to try to carry the theme that Rob McKenna was not who he said he was.
Pepl views this network of nonprofits as a permanent Democratic campaign.
If the public knew what they were doing and how a very small number of very liberal donors are controlling state politics, that would be a cause for concern.
In 2012, Washington voters not only elected Democrat Jay Inslee governor, they upheld same-sex marriage and legalized marijuana. The voter database that helped make that happen is run by yet another nonprofit social welfare group called Win-Win Action. I asked Executive Director Dana Laurent, is this a vast left-wing conspiracy to take over the state?
It's a vast left-wing conspiracy to make people's lives better. But, you know, seriously, you know, all of the organizations that sit around the win-win table are nonpartisan organizations. So this is definitely not a wing of the Democratic Party.
But the Democratic Party may soon benefit from Laurent's experience inside Washington's progressive network. She's currently a top contender to become the next chair of the Washington State Democratic Party. I'm Austin Jenkins reporting.
Still ahead, almost every American participates in a paycheck insurance program that you can't outlive. It's Social Security. We'll hear from an expert who says if you aren't already drawing benefits from the program, it's a near certainty that someday you will be. We'll hear more coming up just after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Today, mostly sunny, highs 50 to 55 degrees with east winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. Then tonight, clear with overnight lows in the low 40s, continued east winds. Tomorrow, another sunny day with highs in the mid-50s, continued east winds 10 to 15 miles per hour and gusting to 30 miles per hour. Gordon McCraw, meteorologist and director of Tillamook Emergency Management, says look for clear skies and mild temperatures with some gusty east winds developing 10 to 15 miles per hour, gusting to 20 during the day and evening. And the weekend, in a word, nice. We can expect sunny skies tomorrow and Saturday with a few clouds moving in Sunday. Highs in the upper 50s, lows in the low to mid 30s. There's also a chance of some patchy morning fog over the weekend as the east winds die down. The long-range models suggest a pattern change is finally coming next week, so if you have outside work to do, get it done this week. On the Coast Community Calendar, the annual Tillamook Homeless Connect event will take place today from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. at the Sacred Heart Catholic Church Gymnasium at 2411 5th Street. Free hot meals, clothing, tents, tarps, vaccinations, haircuts, pet care, and more will be offered for those in need. The fifth annual project Homeless Connect for Clatsop County takes place next Thursday, January 30th, from 10 to 3 at the Seaside Convention Center. Services include medical screenings, immunizations, food stamps, information about housing, employment, legal aid, and more. Hot meals will be served. Ride the bus for free all day. For more information, call 503-325-1400. Clatsop Community College and the Fort George Brewery announced the next Ales and Ideas education series, Should Technology Be Beautiful? A Philosophical Approach, with Seth Chichner. That's taking place tonight at 7 at the Fort George Lovell Showroom at 14th and Duane in Astoria. All ages are welcome. Also tonight, the Big O Saloon in Olney presents a screening of Sometimes a Great Notion, hosted by Matt Love, author of Sometimes a Great Movie. It's taking place at 7 with trivia contest and prizes. And Oregon Senator Ron Wyden is holding a town meeting in Astoria on Saturday. The meeting will be held at 1 p.m. at the Columbia River Maritime Museum, 1792 Marine Drive in Astoria. What if you could buy into an income insurance program which would, one, guarantee you a monthly check for the duration of your life, two, would keep up with inflation with cost of living increases, and three, would continue payments to your spouse and eligible dependents after your death? Well, chances are you have been buying into such a program ever since you entered the workforce. The program is Social Security, and if you didn't recognize it, you're not alone. This week, the North Coast chapter of Thrivent Financial brought in Andy Landis, a veteran of over 10 years working for Social Security, to Astoria to conduct a day of workshops to help future retirees best determine their own strategies for accessing Social Security benefits. Landis said to think of Social Security as a paycheck insurance program, not an investment program. Funded solely by worker payroll deductions, costs and risks are shared by millions of participating workers. Detractors sometimes use the word entitlement to describe the program. Landis said the word can be an accurate way to refer to it.
Technically, Social Security is an entitlement because an entitlement is something that the title gets transferred on. And when you go on Social Security, it's like you're receiving the title to that property. You are entitled to that payment. The problem is that in common slang, entitlement means welfare. Welfare is an entitlement, but it's a needs-based entitlement. Social Security is an entitlement that's not needs-based. So if I was being extremely technical, I would say Social Security is an entitlement technically, but it's not an entitlement the way people throw that word around.
You would be hard-pressed to find an American who will not be eligible to receive Social Security payments after reaching filing age. Those who have worked and had payroll deductions for 10 years, not necessarily consecutively, or those who have been married for 10 years to a participating worker will be able to receive benefits under the program.
Bottom line is, there's people that are not eligible for Social Security, but it's pretty rare. Usually recent immigrant, the trust fund baby, if you will, somebody that does not have a work history because they have other means to support themselves, certain public assistance households that don't have a work history sufficient, but most workers are eligible for Social Security. 10 years scattered anywhere in your career.
Landis says claims that Social Security will no longer be solvent when Americans reach retirement age are largely overblown. He says the system is currently running a $2.7 trillion reserve, and funds are predicted to provide for 100% of benefits until the year 2033. He says failing an overhaul of the system, benefits would still run at 77% after 2033. The last major overhaul of the system was in 1983, resulting in a projected extension of another 50 years of full benefits, and the system has kept track with that projection. So how much will be in that check when you file for the benefit? The amount you earn during your working years and the age you start payments are the major factors here. You'll receive a 100% benefit if you wait until your full retirement age, currently 66 years of age, before filing. And the amount of your payment will be based on your lifetime earning average with the best 35 years of income as the basis for the calculation. Landis went on to address some common misconceptions about Social Security payments.
One, Social Security payment is based on my last 10 years of work or my best 10 years of work. Not true. 10 years gets you eligible, and then people think that determines the payment, but it doesn't. It's a 35-year computation. Second, if I take it early at 62, I'll get a 75% payment, but it'll step up to 100% when I hit 66. Doesn't happen, but surprising how many people think that happens. So why not take it early? That's a mistake. Here's another one. Social Security is not going to be there. So put a zero in there for my future retirement estimate. I think that would be a huge mistake. And we see people doing that in their younger years because they think it won't be there. Then it turns out the closer they get to retirement, the more important it becomes to make sure the Social Security is in there. So they do demand that it be included later, and I think that would be wise since it doesn't seem to be going away anytime soon. Social Security is going to go broke 3 years from now, so I better take it now even though I'm only 62 because they won't take it away from me once I'm in. They might have it right about grandfathering, but they've got it all wrong about it going broke in 3 years. So they're driving themselves into a decision that may not be the best for them. So I see people talking like that or writing comments on blogs, that kind of thing, all the time. And I think it's not crime think, but it's probably wrong think.
And finally, Landis says Social Security should be a vital part of everyone's retirement planning. And you're never too young to start preparing your own Social Security strategy.
Every young person that's working should be getting their Social Security statement regularly for a couple reasons. One, you need to start planning a retirement unless you want to work for the rest of your life, which is fine if you want to do that. But if you ever want to have the choice to retire, you need to start doing that now. And you need to know how much Social Security is going to chip in on that. And you need to know what kind of payments you could get, heaven forbid, if you should die or become disabled mid-career. You cannot do your private disability insurance planning or your private life insurance planning until you know what Social Security is going to start with. That's your foundation. So you got to do that. And you've got to check your earnings record every few years. If they miss a year, then you're not getting credit for the work you did. You wouldn't do that anyplace else. You wouldn't pay a bill and then get double billed for it and never say, hey, I paid twice for that. You want to make sure you're getting credit for the work you did. Worst case I've ever seen was Boeing Corporation, 1977. The entire corporation dropped off Social Security's earnings records. It was rapidly fixed, but there might be a typo on your earnings record or something like that, so you're not getting credit. You need to check on that every couple of years. Long roundabout way of saying every young person should get their Social Security statement, start their My Social Security account so they can get that. Maybe work with a planner for the long run, but at least be checking up on it so they know where they stand. You wouldn't ignore your bank balance. You wouldn't ignore your 401k balance. You've got a balance at Social Security, too. You better find out what it is.
You can check your earnings record and find out more about Social Security planning on the web at ssa.gov. Due to the more than expected turnout for Monday's workshops, the North Coast chapter of Thrivent will likely hold another series of workshops later this year. As a postscript, Monday's workshop space was donated by a new Astoria business, Co-Commercial, at 1412 Commercial Street. That's all the time we have for today's show. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you join the show late, you can listen to a podcast of the show from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the homepage. We welcome your comments on the show. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1@coastradio.org. That's N-E-W-S, then the numeral 1, at KMUN.org. I'm Kathleen Morgane saying thank you for listening today, and listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.